Hello and welcome to Strangers Stopping Strangers, podcast number 52. A big welcome back to anyone who's returning, and thanks for stopping in to anybody who's new this week. Well, this week's podcast with Nathan Duvall was such a blast. So much fun. We kick it off with a little hello and thank you to Deb Solomon, the woman behind Wall Street Dead Ahead Networking, and our friend that we met through. You know, I looked through the episode archives, and Nathan is the seventh guest that I've met through Deb. So, needless to say, I've done some pretty amazing networking, and really all of those guests I am still in touch with and consider friends. So, I'm pretty sure Nathan is definitely not going to be the last. Nathan is a very articulate and animated storyteller. We hear all of the thoughts and meanings behind his five song picks, from his experiences at his first show in 1987, some wild camping stories from over that summer, and we talk about the smoking hot shows that were played in Brent's final years and a lot of the feelings behind that. After the five song picks, we are treated to still a couple more incredible stories. The first one being an amazing family connection, and that led to the inspiration for the beautiful artwork chosen for today's podcast, an original creation by Antonio Renegro, friend of Deb's. I'll put his website on the blog. Such cool stuff. And the other leads us to a fascinating creation of a classic anthem that I'm really excited to share. This podcast is so full of fun and just killer tunes that all I can really say to sum it up is fuck yeah. So, as always, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoy, and I will catch you in a couple weeks. Nathan Duvall, welcome to Stranger Stopping Strangers.
Hi,
Stacey.
Hi.
Hello. Hi, Stacey.
Hi, this is so fun. I'm so excited that you are on the podcast.
I'm really excited to be here. I love your show, and I can't wait to share with you.
I'm excited for everyone to hear. And I think before we even say anything, we have to give the biggest shout out to our sister, our friend, and the reason we've met, which is...
Woo!
Deb.
Deb Solomon.
Deb.
And Deb we trust.
In Deb we trust. And we've met through Deb a couple times, but we just are coming off the most amazing event that she put on Tuesday night, and it was just off the hook.
It was beautiful. I just talked to her on the phone yesterday to congratulate her, and the space itself, 404, was beautiful. I think everyone even got dressed up. They went a step further because it was such a just an amazing spot, and all those white walls allowed for the visuals, and yeah, it was great. It was just an amazing, amazing night.
Well, shout out to all Wall Street Dead Ahead family and Deb Solomon. Woohoo!
Woo!
Yay! And all the sponsors and everyone was there. So good. So fun. Thank you. Can't wait until next year. Awesome.
It is. And you make friends and you end up running around the country trying to catch up with each other. It's so much fun.
I have never met a bad egg through Deb. She has the most amazing vetting process of human nature that I've ever come across.
And she does. And she has a really good reputation within the close-knit actual Grateful Dead family. So you can meet so many interesting characters. I mean, the first event I went to, I met John Perry Barlow. I think I was in shock while I was talking to him. And then later, like the whole year afterward, I'm like, I met John Perry Barlow. I was talking to him about my favorite song. And you know, Jerry Lynn and all the different characters, Cameron Sears. I mean, just on and on with all the people that you can meet. Trixie. Yeah. I was shushed by Mountain Girl at a Rex benefit show. It was so much fun.
It's unbelievable. And everyone's having fun, you know, it's just chill and fun. So that is where we are coming off of. But today we're going to throw it back. We're going to throw it back to your story. And, you know, usually I'd like to kind of start in the beginning. So Nathan, tell me how you started down this crazy rabbit hole of being a deadhead.
I'm pretty lucky. My parents met in 1965 in San Francisco. They were at the San Francisco State. They started going to some of the first be-ins. They were just literally like get-togethers in the park. And my mom was a huge Janis Joplin fan. And they they really instilled with me this passion for music, and they had a great record collection. So over the years, until they got divorced, really, I was just obsessed with their record collection. And the Grateful Dead was always there. A lot of the Quicksilver Messenger Service, a lot of the bands that came out of that era, and like a Family Dog. We had this giant poster that was up on our wall. It was a poster of San Francisco, and it was an illustration, and it kind of showed. It had like the Fillmore and the Family Dog, Avalon Ballroom. They had all these locations throughout the city that were famous or icons throughout the city. And so I would look at that picture, and there's a big Grateful Dead symbol. Like there was a Jefferson airplane. There was this huge Jefferson airplane that was flying through the city. And so I would just stare at this picture and go, wow, what's a Jefferson airplane? And who are the Grateful Dead? And what is all this stuff? And then later, as I became a teenager, I started to really understand the history and everything that went into the scene from the 60s going in the 70s. And at the same time, it's your parents' thing. So by the time I was like 16 or 17, I wasn't necessarily listening to that music anymore. And by the time I got to 18 and 19, I was definitely, I'm like, oh man, the Grateful Dead, whatever, a bunch of old guys. And my friends who were at UCSB at the time were like, we're going to take you to the show. Jerry's back from this coma, and it's really going to be amazing. You got to come. And I'm like, I don't want to go. And so they literally bought me a ticket. My buddy Howard Lair and Johnny Castle bought me a ticket for that first. It was a Friday night in April of 87. At Irvine Meadows, and they're like, you're going to the show. We don't care what you have to say. And they promised me, they're like, look, there's going to be like, amazing drugs and open-minded women, and there's drum solos. You're a drummer. Go to the show.
You're going to get drums. You're going to get laid, and you're going to get high. So even if you don't like the music, just enjoy, the chicks and getting high and the drums. And
that was it.
You're good. Yeah, nothing exactly. To lose.
You're 18. I was 18 at the time, and I'm like, all right, fine, I'll go. And so I went, and as soon as I always remember that first time, like when we pulled into the parking lot and seeing all these people throwing frisbees and girls running around topless and just the insanity of it. And as soon as we got out of the car, like people were being friendly to you. I'm like, what is going on? I'm from LA. Everyone's mean and tough and weird. I'm like, this is so strange. And people just the stranger stopping strangers attitude, like just, welcoming you into the scene. And that first weekend, we had a great time. And I think you'll hear that some of the songs were referenced. What I find funny is that at the time, I couldn't even listen to reggae because it was too slow for me. I was listening to a lot of like metal and speed metal and punk. And I just, everything had to be fast. I was still a kid, so I'm full of testosterone. And for whatever reason, it really kind of like slowed me down and kind of, brought me to a better place from being so fast. And what I find funny is that when you listen to the show, Eyes of the World is the fastest Eyes of the World you'll ever hear. And I like to think that, my friends are just there's a whole new generation of kids that started showing up in 87. And I do think we had something to do with that we were so excitable and so manic that they went. I mean, you could hear Jerry.
They just revved it up to like match the vibe of the scene. They were like, I believe that, absolutely.
You can feel it's hilarious. I mean, I think at some point you can hear Jerry while he's trying to sing the lyrics. He laughs or he chuckles because he's like, "What is this? Like 160 RPM? What's going on? Like it's really fast." Anyway, I like to believe, that somehow we affected him that night. But yeah, that's where we were. We were just, a bunch of really revved up kids, and we definitely got a bad reputation for sure because we were part of that in the dark crowd. And I know a lot of the older deadheads were not happy with us, and we didn't. It took a while to understand where we were, in the whole timeline of the Grateful Dead. We were just kind of, understanding the songbook and kind of figuring out where we fit in the scene. And we're just really pumped and excited, and a lot of older deadheads really took offense to that. And I know that there was, I started to understand, I'm like, oh, okay, there are rules and etiquette here, and don't just plow your way to the front, which is what we did. We just didn't know better. For better or worse, I learned a lot of etiquette, and I became, much better deadhead, as you might say, as the years went on. But yeah, we were part of that, rebellious 87 crew that came in and just raised hell.
Oh, I love it. I mean, I feel like there's so many different like chapters, within the time of the Grateful Dead and and there's this has been a topic so many times on the podcast, and you and I had just chatted about it. You know, it's the Deadhead community, the spirit, the music, it still goes on. You know, I mean, there's been some times that have been more ebbs than flows, and I think right now we're at a really big flow time, which is amazing. But I always laugh because, you know, me being in my 40s and seeing the Grateful Dead in the late 80s into the 90s, you know, we come from that background, and the kids that you meet, I mean, you know, the same thing is going on now, where people who saw the Grateful Dead or people who, you know, used to go in the 70s or the 80s, you know, they can't wrap their mind around these kids. And all I always think back to is I was one of those kids, you know. It was, you never saw Pigpen, you know, you weren't there in the 70s. Like, the fuck do you know, you know? Like, who are you? You're 16 years old. How do you possibly understand that, you know, what this is all about? And, you know, and then I think we learned. We stopped and we listened and we learned, and then we did understand it. And now we're the old fucks, you know?
I'm much more cognizant of that, and I definitely put my best foot forward. In fact, at Citi Field, I met a bunch of kids that we kind of partied with, and I think they were around the same age. They were 19 or 20, and they were asking me questions, and they were much more polite than I was. And I told them that. I'm like, hey, you guys are much more mature and together than I was at your age, and you know, we really appreciate the fact that you're polite and, you know, and you're mindful of your space and what you're doing. And yeah, it's great to see. I think, in fact, I would say that the generation coming up now that's going to see Dead and Company and all the offshoots are super polite, and they're really cool. I haven't come across any of the, you know, wildness that you saw even in like that, you know, the disastrous 95 tour. I really haven't come across that at all. People have been really polite.
Well, I love me. I call them the 21st century Deadheads. I've had a handful of them on the podcast. I'm due to have a 21st century. It's been a little while, but I'll do a little shout out to Ian and Connor and, Ben, if you guys are listening, and yeah. Eli, yay! Like, it's so fun. Woo! It's so fun hearing their stories and their experiences, because they're, you know, and it's interesting. We'll go play Eyes of the World now, but Eyes of the World, I mean, that song has been chosen. I know it was Connor's first song, because it's just this cycle that repeats itself in generations and generations, and we come from all over the country, sometimes all over the world, and all different generations, yet you're there with all the people and the music and the smell, you know, the patchouli and the pot and that, you know, the sweat and, you know, like just that smell and this, yeah, and they play it and you're like, oh my God, I'm home, this is it. And it's so special, and I love that, and I love hearing, again, all the different generations, and I love that you chose Eyes of the World, because it's been a, you know, a lot of times this podcast have now come into how did you, you know, what was your first, like, intro, and just the whole, I don't know, the lyrics, the meaning, I mean, what the song is about just really lends itself to, you know, an awakening, right?
Right, absolutely, and I don't think I really understood. I mean, maybe subconsciously I did while, you know, hearing that set, but definitely going back, when I look at that set on archive, I had so many of those songs that I witnessed on that first show. I ended up seeing a lot later on. I thought that was really interesting, but yeah, you're right, and it's a perfect metaphor. And here, as you segue into it, that this is the Eyes of the World bluegrass speed metal version. Enjoy the tempo here.
We are going to be throwing this back to Irvine on April 17th, 1987, Eyes of the World. Enjoy.
Joy.
We are back from listening to Eyes of the World from April 1987. And, you know, as the podcasts are a bit of a digital songbook to your life, I'm looking, the next one is in June 87. So that must have been a pretty intense couple of months. I want to hear a little bit about that.
It was. And, you know, the more I look back on it, the more I'm like happy that everyone is alive and has their limbs. That whole like spring into summer, there was a lot of like 20th anniversary stuff going back to the Summer of Love, 1967. So like 87 and 88, there was a lot of reflection going on for older Deadheads and just that generation in general. And it seemed like there was a lot going on like in that springtime. So we saw that show at Irvine in 87. And I think that following Tuesday was the U2 Joshua Tree tour came through. And so all these people, you know, bought tons of LSD and then, you know, saw the Dead. And then like, you know, 2 days, 3 days later, it's the Joshua Tree and you're freaking out there. Those months were just so packed with so many, I think the Cult, it's just on and on, all these bands that were rolling through. And it was just one after the other, along with these sort of, these acts that had been around a long time that were kind of being rediscovered by our generation. And yeah, so it was super intense. And I'll say this, like I really started, you know, being like a psycho cowboy somewhere around 16 or 17. So I was, maybe I had 2 years experience and I was a little more experienced than some of my friends. And they would generally look to me to like, okay, you're driving us out of the parking lot or you're in charge when we leave here to get to the hotel or friend's house or whatever. So there's a ton of driving and we really cut our teeth on how to be, as responsible as we could. And drive all around the state to see these shows. And so what happened is I had this introduction to the Grateful Dead at the Irvine Meadows, and I'm like, wow, okay, I really like this. I want to go to the Ventura Fairgrounds show, which was in June of 87, a couple of months later. And that's around the time when I really started absorbing the songbook, going, wow, okay, I need to know what's going on here. I can tell that there's a wealth of music. And I just, I night and day, I was listening, you know, to the Grateful Dead and a lot of other bands. And what happened is what was interesting is it turned out to be the last time the Grateful Dead played Ventura. And it was just getting to the point where they were just getting overrun, especially in Southern California, because there's so many universities there. You had Irvine, UCSB, USC, UCLA, and there's this whole wave of kids that were being turned on by Touch of Grey in the Dark. That definitely was like a touchstone. And these kids are, and you've got like the 20th anniversary. And so people are like, you know, what the fuck is going on? And that was really the last time that they could have this sort of quaint get together in Ventura. What was awesome was that the Ventura Fairgrounds is this giant like racetrack type thing. And it was overlooked by the Holiday Inn. There was like a, I don't know, 12 story Holiday Inn that faced the fairgrounds. And so everyone would try and, you know, vie for that perfect position with a balcony facing the fairgrounds. And then they would hang these giant tie dyes. And so we all descended on this place on the Friday night. And I made this stupid mistake. I got there Friday night and someone sold me some acid at like 2 a.m. And I'm like, well, just want to make sure it's good. And so we tried it. Not, you know, again, like you're learning, you know, what to do, what not to do. That's definitely something not to do. And but I did it, and the what I learned from it was that number one thing was that, you know, if you're gonna do something like that in the middle of the night, you know, and you don't take care of yourself water wise or stay hydrated or really understand your energy level, you're probably not gonna be worth much later in the afternoon. And the upside of that though is that what happened is I really started to come on about like sunrise, and I was walking around the village, and I got to see people waking up in the morning. You know, opening kind of like, yeah, the whole Eyes of the World metaphor, opening up their tent, and they'd walk out and they'd see me walking around. And I think I said good morning to everyone who woke up out of their tent. I would personally walk up, I'm like, good morning. Hi, my name is Nathan, and good morning. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, and I'm sure they were thrilled to have you wake up to say good morning, too. You know, I mean, it's like the one environment where everyone's just like, yeah, there's a, you know, the welcome wagon has come by, but nobody even thought it was strange at all.
Exactly. I think someone served me breakfast, and I think at one point I was crying. I was like, thank you so much for these eggs. I couldn't believe like how friendly people were, because I'm just used to like a harder edged tower, upbringing in LA. And so I was just like, wow, these people are so friendly. And what was lucky about it, and when I look back on it, is that they had this camping experience, and then Calaveras County went on that same year, which was a legendary show. I didn't get to that one. And then the following year was the last time in 88, Laguna Seca.
Laguna Seca. Yeah.
That was the last real camping, show they had in California, because it just got overrun. And that's what happened here in 87, was that we showed up on Friday and you had me running around in the morning, saying good morning to everybody. And then we noticed by like 9 or 10, there were people everywhere. There were people like, vagrant type deadheads sleeping in the bushes. And you'd see these families, and I felt so bad, because you'd see these families who were out there for their, they were probably from the Midwest or something. And, oh, hey, this is our big vacation, our family vacation. And they'd come out and there's like a guy changing his underwear near the pool, and people coming out of the woodwork, and they just horrified. And you're like, hey, man, good morning. And that did not endear them to the locals.
No, it's so awesome. Well, it's like, and I'm listening and I'm thinking my sister, who was on the podcast, Hey Michelle, her first show was Laguna Seca doing camping show. And then her next one was Calaveras County. So it's funny. I think I always, at some point in time, I feel like I used to pretend that I was at the Laguna Seca and the Calaveras counties, because I'm a little sister, and that's just what little sisters do, is they hijack their big sisters' like lives, So when people would like talk about counting how many shows or when did they first go, I think there was a point in my life where I pretended that I was at those shows, even though I wasn't, because I was just the jealous little sister that was home behind. I was in eighth grade and she was a senior in high school, so she's 4 years older than I, and I kind of jumped on the next year. But I love hearing about, these camping shows, because I was there vicariously watching Michelle go off with her friends and have this great time, and there was just no place I would have rather been, than to be with my big sister and all her cool friends. And I was getting turned on to the music at the time, and I was, I was 13, eighth grade, and there was no fucking way that I was going to be allowed, nor did she want her eighth grade, 13-year-old sister to be joining as well. But I thought I was there. I thought, she's there, I'm there, we're all equals, let's make this happen. And so I feel like I was there, even though I absolutely was not. And the last thing I have to laugh about when you're talking is I always would giggle for years after when the San Francisco Chronicle would come and they'd have the pages with all the things that are going on, all the shows. And when the Grateful Dead would come to town, it would be the only ad that would show up that would say, no camping. No camping, And I just went without any, any other band that would be coming through the Bay Area. It would just be the band. They'd be playing at Cal Expo. They'd be playing at Shoreline, and they would have their ad. And then the Grateful Dead in big, bold, no camping. You just let us just say this one more time. No fucking camping, you dirty hippies, But like every other band would just be like, yeah, so-and-so is playing it. Sting's coming to the Oakland Coliseum or whatever. And I never questioned if you guys were going to be camping. Bill Collins is coming. Eric Clapton's coming. Like, cool bands too, And it'd just be like, yeah, Eric Clapton's going to be playing at the Oakland Coliseum in November. The Grateful Dead's coming. No camping.
It would say, in fact, on the tickets, I remember the Ticketmaster tickets, it would say no camping vending, no camping / vending in bold, just to drive it home.
Yeah, it's just mass people. No, absolutely. But, I'm glad you got to experience it. And I like to pretend I experienced it. So we're going to pretend that I did as well.
There you go.
Again, what little sister doesn't like to hijack their older sister's experiences? So in my mind, I was really there.
And it makes for more fun conversations when, you're in the dark in a backyard. Like, oh, yeah, I was there, Calaveras County, 87.
Totally. Yeah, I was there. Yeah, it was totally cool. Yeah, we did mushrooms. It was awesome. No, I was in eighth grade. Yeah.
I have a pretty, I'm pretty good with memory. I think at the time too, I wasn't drinking a lot, which would probably help. You do psychedelics, and as a kid, you couldn't afford to do a lot of drinking or anything like that. And I do have this one clear memory, like before we get to the song. I know this is a different show, but that Laguna Seca show in 88, or that weekend, they played with Los Lobos, which I think was the first time I saw Los Lobos. And I saw it both times. I saw the end of their set. I didn't really make most of it. But one thing I do remember clearly was being on the, I guess it would be stage right, like facing the left side of the stage. At Laguna Seca, they had it was sort of like in a natural amphitheater. So on both sides of the stage, there would be a hillside. And on the hillside, on stage right, there was a kite flying area. And you could,
that's awesome.
You could go over there and, like, well, you could ask somebody, you know, if they let you, you know, share their kite with them, or you could just sit there. And we were sitting there watching the kites flying, and we heard this motorcycle, this dirt bike, tearing up the side of the hill. And I'm like, what the fuck? Who would be able to do that? And we're looking, and then we see the guy pull up right next, like, he's about, I don't know, 30 feet from us, stops, and he looks over at us. And I kind of look at him, I'm like, God, he looks familiar. And he kind of shakes his head. I'm like, wait a minute. And I point at him, I go, hey, I'm like, that's Bill Graham. And I look at him, I wave, and he looks at me. He doesn't smile. He looked at me, and he kind of shook his head, and then drove off. And looking back on it, I know what he was thinking. He was looking at us, and he was going, that's it. This is over. What you're looking at and what you're experiencing is done. And I didn't, you know, I didn't really get the breadth of it and how meaningful it was. And I feel so lucky that I got to I've done that a lot in my musical history. I show up right at the end, whether it's Jane's Addiction or the Grateful Dead or whoever it might be. I tend to show up right at the end of a scene. I'm like, oh, this is amazing. And it's gone. God damn it. But I do feel really lucky that I got to see that. Because we have a history too in our family. My mom wrote Bill Graham at some point. She had a bad experience at the Fillmore, and she wrote him and said, you know, whatever it was, and he sent her free tickets later, saying, I'm sorry for your your bad experience. And because he was always so customer service minded, he gave her these tickets. And my mom always talked about that, saying Bill Graham was a decent businessman and a decent human being, and getting to see him like that. And I ended up talking to him later on, years later, at some of the shows. I saw him. He's like, yeah. He's like, I don't know if that's what I was thinking at the moment, but yes, that you are right. That I was definitely feeling that in my heart, that we'll never experience this kind of community again. And kind of like, yeah, hey kid, you just don't understand what you're missing. And now looking back, I do. And I'm so thankful that I got to see the village and people living in teepees and all that. It was really magical. And I feel so lucky.
That's awesome. Well, let's go back. We don't all get to go to we're not going back to Laguna Seca, but we're going to go back to Ventura, which it sounds like is another segment of the magical time and some similarities there. And you chose Hell in a Bucket. So tell us a little bit about that pick.
It's my favorite song. And I love so many songs, like, you know, the other one or Stella Blue or whatever it might be. But this song is, I guess it's just more speaks to my generation of kids that started up there in 87. And that's, I think that's why I chose it. And I love the theme too, that, you know, no matter how bad it is or what's going on, if you can find a way to enjoy yourself in that moment, you know, at least you're enjoying the ride, no matter how fucked up it is. And it's a fast song.
And it's a fast song. That's what I was just thinking. Like, I definitely, it's definitely a high speed up rocking, you know, shaking rocking song. So that plays into that for
and
sure.
This version is particularly good. And this is the other reason too, is that this was the first show where I really started to understand the songs. Like, Wharf Rat was big on this one. They do a Scarlet Fire. And I really started to understand the arrangements. I was really starting to sink in. And on this version of Hell in the Bucket, you got the ending is so much fun because they're really playing with the audio. The house sound guys are messing with Bobby's vocals, and it's really fun. So check out the ending.
Sounds good. All right. Well, let's go in and play. And this is from June 14th, 1987. So everybody, we're going to Hell in a Bucket, but at least we're enjoying the ride.
Quite proud. Never mind, I'm stumbling for. No, never mind, I'm stumbling.
Listening to Hell in a Bucket, I'm looking at the next song that we're going to discuss, and we are going to be taking it down a couple of notches from the high-paced energy, and this is less about a show but more about a song. So tell us a little bit about the next choice.
Sure. So this is Althea, and I know that with John Mayer's obsession with a song, it's definitely become a touchstone of late. And with this song, I think it's another one of those subconscious things where I took it in because the title is also the name of my godmother, my Aunt Althea. And so when I heard the lyric come up, I'm like, oh, hey, I have an Aunt Althea. And she really meant a lot to me. She was a special person. And she was, at one point, she was married to the second or the first top LSD producer in the country. And then, you know, her life changed when he ended up going to prison, and it was pretty challenging for her. She was dogged by the IRS, and she definitely had a tough life, after that period. But she was always, because she was my godmother, she was always open with me. She was a lesbian, and she just opened my mind to a different way of thinking, a different way of approaching life. And so when I first heard this song, it definitely, you know, kind of hit me, but I didn't really take it in fully until later. I'd say maybe it's Without a Net. When I heard that version, it all kind of clicked. And then I went back to this show in 87. And I realized, I'm like, yeah, wow, this song has always been here and been with me. And I guess that's one of the reasons I love it so much, is that it's a thoughtful, sweet song. And Jerry just kind of, you know, taking you on a walk down the road, and it just makes me feel good. And I love my Aunt Althea, so I'd like to, I'm sending this out to her, wherever she may be in the cosmos. Go, Jerry.
Sounds good. No, I love this song too. And this song is one of those songs that I love, that there's so much interpretation when you talk to people about it. Cause I think, you know, there's a story that's being told. And I think that, but in the classic, you know, Robert Hunter, Jerry Garcia ways, it's a story, but it's open to a lot of different interpretations. You know, who is he talking about? You can tell that there's definitely some heartache, and there's love, and there's, you know, there's looking, you know, obviously looking for direction and figuring things out. But who's asking who, what, and who's, you know, is, I don't know. It's all, you know, it's all very cloudy, and you can kind of come out of it whatever you put into it.
Exactly. That's what makes a great song, is the ability for the listener to choose their own point of view. And it's rare, because you usually have a song that's a little more explicit. And just like you said, Robert Hunter gives you the opportunity to approach it, at, like you said, as it could be a lover, it could be a family, it could be a friendship, it could be just about anything, how you want to apply it. And that's what makes it, that's why it continues to be loved, because you have all these different points of view.
Oh, absolutely. And I've used it as a meme before. I'm a big, I don't know if I've admitted this on the podcast before, but I mean, it's something to admit. It's something I truly love, is I'm a big Bravo fan. Andy Cohen, if you're ever listening, hey now, like, super Bravo, super fan. And so for
Bravo.
A little while, about, I love my Bravo TV. And for a little while, I got obsessed with making Bravo Housewives memes. And this song had so many good lyrics for it. I mean, you know, you may be a clown in the burying ground, or just another pretty face. I mean, that was, I mean, it's classic Bravo Housewives, like gold within this song. I think I ended up with one whose name I won't mention, but one of the beautiful housewives that I follow was honest to the point of recklessness, self-centered to the extreme.
Nice.
And it just
Perfect.
Works, you know, Perfect. It just works. And you know, it's coming from a place of love and devotion. I mean, I have to say, after the Deadhead community, Andy Cohen and Bravo Television is probably, like, you know, number two hours of entertainment that
right.
has given me.
So,
yeah, no, it's a juxtaposition, you know, like it's like the light is the Dead community, and it, like the yin and the yang, and then the other side is, you know, all things Bravo. And
Andy Cohen's awesome. He's a great host. I love him.
Ah, he's amazing. Yeah. I mean, and there's a lot of us out there. So for anyone who's listening to this podcast and they listen and they want to reach out, send me an email. I call us unicorns. Like, there's a big group of us, the Bravo superfan Deadheads. It's this really bizarre juxtaposition, but we're out there. Like, we are. So
if
anyone's listening, please let me know, because there's just nothing more special than someone I could toggle conversations between what's happening on The Housewives and what's happening on tour. You know, it's
that's funny.
That's awesome. All right, well, let's go play this, and then we will be back, as we have a couple more songs to discuss. So we're staying put in June 14th, 1987 for this one. Yes?
Take it away. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're still in Ventura, but we're going down another path. So everybody enjoy, and we'll be back.
Woohoo.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, back from listening to Althea, and we're going to hop down the road a couple of years to June of 1990, and you selected Mama Tried. So tell us a little bit about this pick.
It's a burning set, and personally, where I was at this point was I had my first real girlfriend. She was near, I think, graduating UCLA, or no, she's probably midway through UCLA. And we had a friend who was graduating the next day. So I can't remember why or how but we're like, we've got to get to the show up at Shoreline. And so we went up. It was one of those, you know, wild rides. We just drove overnight and got there and got a ticket and were up there on the lawn. And it just happened to be one of those magical sets. I thought I was at the time. And by then I'm like, I guess I'm like 3 years in. So I know that, yeah, sure, there's some moment you're having a great time with your friends and maybe they're not playing at their top or their best. And it just seems that way. And you listen back to the show and go, okay, well, maybe I was much, you know, in a much happier place than the band was. But this was definitely where you know, the stars aligned. I guess what's pretty heart-wrenching about this is that this is the second to last show that Brent played in California. And it was, I mean, especially when I look back on this as someone who's more of a matured music producer, is that I really understood how valuable he was in the band. During this first set, that's where Mama Tried comes from. He's on fire, and he's always at the center of the vocals, you know, the harmonies. He's holding everything down, and you can hear where Jerry kind of goes flat, or where he's kind of losing it, or where Bobby might hit things too sharp, and he's always there in the pocket. Brent is holding the whole thing down and singing with all this emotion. Ironic, he's not singing much on this song, but what I like about this is I was also starting to learn about country and about Merle Haggard, and I didn't really understand, you know, that whole songbook. And I would definitely say that the Grateful Dead opened my eyes to country music and to bluegrass and all sorts of different music that I didn't really know. And Mama Tried was definitely one of the first songs where I was like, wow, so what's this whole country thing about? I love this story. And I mean, I've read that Billy wasn't so into the cowboy songs, as he called them, but they were fun. And especially if it was a hot day, like you just felt like you were out there in the dusty old West. And anyway, this, I would definitely say you can like go to YouTube and check out this song or check out this both sets on YouTube, because you can see the interplay between Jerry and Brent. They're so happy. Like they are genuinely, you know, upbeat. At the same time, you can see Brent is struggling. His eyes are popping out of his head, and he definitely looks messed up, but he's in love with the songs and he's holding everything down. And the more I read about it, the more I read about this time period, I've come to understand why Jerry had such a decline, because he did really feel that when Brent died, that he may have lost the band, that was their final high mark. And I know a lot of people, you know, that you could argue about this all, you know, till the end of time, but in my heart of hearts, I can understand why Jerry would feel that way, because they never did really recover vocally after he died. It was so tight. And after that, you know, they were out there on their own. And if they made mistakes, there was no one there to hold them down. So check out both sets. And then if you're not familiar with country music or the songbook, this is a great entry, Mama Tried.
Right on. Yeah, such a special time. And I mean, I think about the relationship, and I've, you know, talked to many people, obviously, and, you know, really given a lot more thought in the last year or so. And I mean, where there's pain, there's beauty. And I feel like at the end, like with the Without Annette and at this time, I mean, he was in so much pain. And with that came just this passion of the singing. And I think another, you know, from my perspective and pulling everything together, not my perspective from the time, but in, you know, archiving the situations, I think, you know, both of them using and both of them, you know, having that addiction, it's like, it's this dirty secret that you share that creates this brotherhood together. And I think watching, you know, Brent go through that, I'm sure it was heart-wrenching, because it's got to have put a bit of a mirror up for him as well, right? I mean, you share this and you're bringing so much pain and so much passion, and then to see Brent, you know, come to an end with it. I mean, I can't imagine how that wouldn't just, you know, mortally be wounding.
That's a really good point. It's funny. It's not funny, but I don't go there a lot because that does hurt so much. And you're absolutely right. I mean, at the core of it, you're right that probably has a lot to do with their friendship or their kismet on stage. And I just,
at the end, yeah. Probably not the whole relationship, but I just think at the end, you know, like that's something that they were, you know, again, that's something they were doing. They were both, it was part of their, you know, doing.
You have to admit it. It's not something you can gloss over. And I do think it gets a little bit glossed over. And at the same time, just like you said, there, you know, the beauty that comes out of that pain, and sure, they were both going down a similar road there, yet they would get on stage and regardless of the chemicals that were going on, they did have this musical relationship where, like, you could tell, like, Brent would do things with his shoulders. He would shake them, and Jerry would take those as signals. And I was always, you really notice it on these videos where the camera is just on, is focused, you know, with them on stage. You can see everything. And I mean, when we were out there in the crowd, it's not so visible, but when I go back and watch this, I'm like, holy shit, they're taking music cues physically without using their eyes necessarily. Without like looking at each other necessarily in the eyes. They would move their bodies, or if Jerry didn't like something, he turned his back on you, and you're pretty clear. You're like, oh, fuck that, you know, or whatever. And you can see, like, between, like, they're smiling through most of the set. They're laughing. They're laughing at some of the things they do. They flub a lyric here or there. But through most of this, like, Bobby is just sort of being really, you know, kind of, I wouldn't say he's like being pretend, but he feels so important. He's so into it. And then finally, Brent and Jerry break him down, and he starts laughing at some point. It's so fun. That set was so much fun.
Oh, well, I'm going to check the whole thing out. And I'm sure I was there. I remember being there. I don't remember the set. Like, I don't remember it to the extent of remembering the actual set. But I don't know. I couldn't tell you a thing about it except that I remember it was the Summer Solstice shows, right? They were a Summer Solstice in Shoreline, and it was right around, right after we got out of school. So I am sure I was there. That was the stomping grounds was, you know, Shoreline, 1990. No way I wasn't there.
Woo! That's awesome.
Woohoo! So, all right, let's go. Let's listen to Mama Try, the song I identify with very much as a mom. And we'll come back with one more story and one more song.
Ooh, take it away. First thing I remember at night was a lonesome for so long.
Well, back from Shoreline in 1990, and we're not in a full time sequence. We have one more song, and we're going to go back to 89. And tell us a little bit about your final pick to play.
This one is a summer solstice show, and I remember this was being it was broadcast on FM. It was probably like God, I can't remember the name of that show right now, but they had like a national syndicated show, and it was so it was on summer solstice. It was hot as fuck, and I remember they had some sort of problem too with the onstage mix, and I think the power went out twice right as they were getting started, and you know they were very impatient, they were getting kind of frustrated, and then finally when it got going, it was another one of those, just they were on fire, like a front loaded type of set. And this version of Cassidy, I think this was around the time too that I was really starting to understand the meaning of the song, and definitely like to send this out to both Cassidy and Cameron, who I met for the first time, Cassidy Law and Cameron. I met them at the Rex Foundation benefit last year in San Francisco. And I was standing at the bar. I had just met Mountain Girl, or she had shushed me because I was being too loud. And so I talked to her a bit. And then this other woman started talking to me. She thought I was funny. And I'm like, hey, my name's Nathan. And she said, my name's Cassidy. And I'm like, the Cassidy? And she smiled and said, yeah, that's me. And she says, I'm like, yeah, I know you're, and it's a combination. I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable. I'm just great to talk to you. And so I got to talk to her for a little bit and Cameron. I didn't even know they were married, and then found out later that they were married. And that's so with this song, it also was a favorite between me and my girlfriend at the time, and we loved to dance to that song. And I'm a huge Neil Cassidy fan. So the fact that this song kind of fuses these two people and means so much to the Grateful Dead family really meant a lot to me. And I started to understand that right around this time. And it just has to be a really good version. Jerry tears it up. And in fact, back to that comment about Brent and Bobby, Brent is fucking solid. He sings his guts out and really helps Bobby, bring it home on this version. So I love it.
I love it. And I love this era. I mean, all of, it's our era. So, we are of this era.
Yeah.
There's so many different eras and we are the Brent era almost, what I like to say, like the kids that came up in, these late 80s, early 90s. And one of my favorite to listen to is Without a Net.
Yeah.
Over and over and over. And I think that as far as accessible Spotify, rolling through it, I think that might be my favorite Cassidy out there, just for not of all Cassidy's ever made, but just the accessibility aspect of rolling it through on Spotify, like it's for the ones that I can just pick, choose, listen, press play, easy peasy, lemon squeezy. But it's that same time. I mean, it's so beautiful. And I absolutely... I'm in 100%. Well, let's go play this.
Woo!
And then woohoo! And then we have one other little special bonus story and song. And so don't leave, even though this is a super long podcast, because we're having so much fun talking, everyone.
Yay.
Be sure to stay tuned. Enjoy. Thank you.
years between now and me, Cassidy. Let your icy heart catch cold trousers and coffin cry. Thank you.
Well, back from listening to Cassidy, this podcast could be 3 hours because we've barely even scratched the surface of the songs, right? Of like your stories. I mean, we've got some good stories and songs in, but you just recently uncovered something amazing that I've learned about, and I want you to share this story because it's really special.
It's a mind blower, and it's worth it. Those of you that are listening right now, especially it's like sounds like a fantasy type story. But the quick of it is this, is that I was estranged from my dad's side of the family. My mom and dad got divorced in the 70s. And so my aunt and my cousins, I wasn't really close with. In fact, I didn't really have any contact with them much until this year, back in April. I was listening to my little Grateful Dead playlist, jogging along, and I started getting texts from my cousins. And they finally called through, and they're like, hey, our mom died, your Aunt Betty has died, and we feel bad about everything that's happened. Would you please come to the funeral? We'd like to try and make it up to you and bring you into the family, and we're so sorry. And so I'm like, well, that's interesting. I'm listening to Feel Like a Stranger right now when you call me. And I'm like, all right, there's probably some weird Grateful Dead connection. I'll go. I'll put my best foot forward. You never know. I might learn something about why I don't really get along with that side of the family. I'm like, all right. So I go to the event, and I'm wearing a poncho I bought that's it's like a Steal Your Face California flag fusion. And this older woman walks up to me, and she says, do you know your Aunt Betty's connection, the Grateful Dead? First she says, like, are you a dead? I'm like, well, yeah, I'm definitely a dead end. And she says, do you know their connection? And I'm like, no, what's that? And then she proceeds to tell me that Jerry Garcia was my aunt's best man at her first wedding. And that's how she starts out. And I was like, whoa.
Wow.
And I'm like, how did that happen? And she said, well, she was known as Queen of the Chateau. And I'm like, well, I'm like, you mean the Chateau, the broke down palace, Menlo Park thing? That, and she, at one point in around 1960, she, her job was to kind of facilitate everyone, all their sleeping arrangements within that like communal living space there in Menlo Park. And she had, various relationships with Robert Hunter and Jerry and a lot of other, I mean, it was a communal thing. Everyone's fucking everybody and going crazy. And one of her main responsibility apparently was to be in charge of the benzos, or the speed that they kept in some giant like vase or something. And that was sort of her job. And then she became pregnant. She and the guy that she got together with decided they were going to move out and get married, and Jerry ended up taking her space. So he was living in a car on the property, and so she moved out, he moved in, and then they got married. And really, what was interesting from that point on, she kind of cut her ties. And we think that, I mean, I put it together with my cousins that we think that she did show up at a show somewhere in the 70s and kind of, just said hello. But that was really it. She wasn't like a hardcore fan or something like that. She was more of a friend that saw all these guys, these people in their formative years, and then didn't really feel the need to like be a hanger on or follow or anything like that. She just, she had her time, and then she, kind of cut her ties and raised her. She ended up, having three children. So she raised her family and lived in a quiet life in Santa Cruz. And so the whole beauty of the moment though was finding all this out and then looking through her music collection and seeing that she liked the same music that I did, all these weird esoteric albums. And it helped me because I didn't really feel connected to my family at all. I'm like, I don't understand. I feel adopted sometimes. And then I'm like, oh, okay, my Aunt Betty, I get it. All right.
And, that's it. Yeah. This is the connection. Oh, that's, you know what? I've got to tell you, like, I learned about this story on a post that you made, and we talked about it the other day. As you're telling the story, and you said it was April, so early May, it was like May 10th maybe, and maybe that was when you just went to the funeral, and it goes back to our first conversation with Deb. I was staying at Deb's house in New York. I was out for I went to a Relics conference, and I was staying over there, and you called her at like, I don't know, like 11 or something maybe, and you had just found all of this out. It was right, it was in early May, and I was at her house, and you were so excited and like talking about it. And I was like, and she like had the call and kind of put her hand by the phone and was like, I'm going to take this. And I think I ended up going to bed while you guys were still talking. It was kind of like the end of the day, end of the night. And we were kind of just, going to sign off and go to bed. And so it's so cool, like so surreal and full circle that, yeah, when you had first discovered this and was sharing it, it was, I was there, like putting on pajamas while you were sharing.
That's what's so cool about this community. I can't say enough about it. Like being part of the Wall Street Deadhead crew after the big reunion in 2015, I just felt I was like I've got to connect with more people. And once I got into the family here, I'm like, oh my God, there's so many other people. Like you're saying, people, you know, of our generation in general. That I can and younger that I can connect with and are as obsessive and crazy and talk fast and are, you know, willing to crisscross the country and all that. And to be able to share this with her. And then she put me in touch with Tony and Tony Rionegro, Antonio Rionegro, who's a, you know, Grateful Dead artist and did a lot of the backstage passes and merchandise and stuff that or shirts that they used in the 80s. Yeah, he designed a shirt for the family called that's called Queen of the Chateau. He kind of created a likeness type portraiture of her, and with, you know, multicolor. And it's just a beautiful shirt with just a small amount of Grateful Dead iconography, and it's beautiful. And so we're printing those shirts for the family and my own family, and they're just so stoked. And the whole thing is a, you know, miracle. It's beautiful.
It is so beautiful, and it's so beautiful again to like hear you tell the story and feel like inside, because it was before we ever met, because I think I met you in June, so I remember the next morning being like, who was that?
Who was that guy? You know?
Yeah, like, who was that guy, you know, because you was on the phone and you were so excited and talking, and I could kind of hear you talking but couldn't hear the story, and it all just come together. And she, you know, gave me like a brief download of it, but no, it's all very cool and all full circle. But we are still not done. We have one more conversation, and this is how you titled your email with the links. And I would be remiss if we didn't like go back and talk about this and do one more little special song. So the connection between the Lord of the Rings. So please share.
Sure. I titled our email How the Grateful Dead Influenced the Lord of the Rings Trilogy. And that's, you know, it might be a little hyperbole, but it is true, because I, like we've been talking about, my formative years were spent, you know, chasing the Grateful Dead around and a lot of, and then, you know, a little later, a lot of the bands of our generation. And, but what I specifically learned from the Grateful Dead was, and what also gave me confidence was the ability to understand where the emotion lies in a song and how to amplify it. Like sometimes, you know, you come out of a show and you've got a melody in your mind. It might be you know, da 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 da, and that section of the song, like it's this hook or a solo, whatever it might be, is just absolutely ingrained and imprinted, you know, on your heart. And I learned that going to those shows, because you'd come out humming those songs and having these connections. And I also I did start to understand how people were listening, band members were listening to each other. And then I would take this and I'd make my wacky mixtapes of all sorts of different types of music, and I'd go into the parking lot and I would act them out. I would literally dance out these songs and people would watch me, and I ended up like creating my own little like tape community, and that led me to have the confidence to be a professional drummer and then a music producer, music supervisor. And this, all of that kind of led me eventually, all that knowledge that I gained led me to establishing the music department at the Ant Farm during the early 2000s, it was the preeminent motion picture advertising, or I should say media advertising firm. And we did everything. We were, you know, we were doing movies, video games, TV shows, just about any kind of, or in some cases, sports and lifestyle advertising. But what I took was all this knowledge I gained from listening to the Grateful Dead and experiencing the shows, and then just condensing it and realizing, okay, I don't have, you know, 8 minutes or more to articulate my story. I just have to take all the emotion from a specific part of a song and adapt it to 30 seconds to a minute and a half to 2.5 minutes. And what happened is I went on to become the music producer and supervisor for the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I worked on a specific with a specific team for Peter Jackson, and that's a long story, but the short of it is it's just a miracle, because that doesn't happen very often where a director has that kind of juice to just run the show. And so I would take what I learned out of Uncle John's band, like the, you know, the solos going out of that song, and I would just, all right, we love this song, we're gonna take all the emotion and we're gonna, you know, encapsulate it in about 30 seconds or a minute and a half. And the big song that came out of Lord of the Rings was Requiem for a Tower. And Requiem for a Tower is based on Clint Mansell's Requiem for a Dream, that the main theme from that movie. And so I took all that knowledge and we adapted that song with a group of composers, and it became the probably the most profitable, one of the biggest songs to ever come out of the trailer industry. It went on to most sports franchises. I mean, the Olympics, NFL, MLB, I mean, you name the Wimbledon, you name it. It's been licensed to major franchises and organizations, and it's generated close to $6 million. And again, that came from that experience. And I built on that from there and decided, all right, you know, one of my favorite bands is Led Zeppelin. I'm going to go after Kashmir. And so I took all that knowledge that I learned from the Lord of the Rings experience. I put it in the song that you're about to play, which I consider, like, if I were to die tomorrow, I would feel okay in that I was able to express myself to the absolute fullest potential. This is the London Symphony Orchestra, basically the Star Wars Orchestra. Damian Marley, Bob's youngest son, singing new inspirational lyrics. Got to have stamina. And some members of Guns N' Roses on it too. And we just,
wow.
It's the same idea. Like we just condensed all of the emotion in Kashmir, and we brought it down to 2 minutes and 30 seconds, gave it an ending. And this song has gone on to generate about $1.5 million. Led Zeppelin's very happy. It's been used in a bunch of campaigns, but this version has not been licensed with Damian Marley. We're waiting for a specific usage. So yeah, when you hear this is me loving the music, taking everything I learned from all those concert experiences from the Grateful Dead and from listening to how, you know, people should interpret cues from each other, and put it all into 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
Well, this is awesome. I'm so excited. I'm excited to hear it. I'm excited to share it. I'm excited for everyone to get out there in our little listenership here. And this is extra bonus material, Stranger Stopping Strangers listeners. So let's go tear it up for 2.5 minutes. We will do the whole song, and then we're going to come back and say goodbye.
Yeah, do it.
Woo, yeah. All right, rock on. Say a goodbye. This was so much fun. I'm so glad we got a chance to do this. So much fun.
Thank you, Stacey. Thanks for offering me the opportunity. You know how it is. It's great to talk about your favorite bands and just obsess. And it, you know, you can't just talk people on the bus. They like, all right, enough about the Grateful Dead. Thank you very much. Like, my wife too. Like, please, please, can we talk about or play anything else but the Grateful Dead?
Oh, Absolutely. Now, my husband's being very tolerant of it all. And the funny thing is people ask me, like, does your husband like the Dead? And I'm like, well, he did. You know, he did. You know, he did. He had a playlist. He did. And I have just completely burned him out of it now, you know. Like, he did like him. Like, he was kind of had a few songs. Then we started dating, and then it went from, like, a few songs to maybe 20 songs.
Oh, you hit it from him, did you? That's funny.
Well, he kind of thought it was cute. Right. And, yeah, well, to your point, like, after 2015, I just became sort of a psycho. And it was, like, something that was in me that was always alive just sort of went – it didn't go away. It just kind of like went into like a part of my life in the background where, you know, you have your relationships and your family and your jobs. And, you know, it's always my favorite music and always part of my spirit, but wasn't part of my like day to day, you know, clothing and obsession and, you know, like all of that kind of
tie-dye
stuff.
Tie-dye again, sweetheart. Okay.
Yeah, totally. Like, you used to wear, you know, like cute little 90s and now you wear your old tour tees, you know. The funniest is, like, I'm a fairly petite woman and I'll wear, like, my tour tees from when I was a teenager and people will be like, they still fit? And I'm like, they were like men's mediums, you know? Like there's nothing sexy about my high school tour tees, you know? They were like that thick cotton, you know, short sleeve, you know, men's shirts. So, yeah, I live in those now. And
it's the same. I think, you know, it's just like you said, it reawakened a lot of those feelings. And you, I mean, it's, to be fair, you know, when Jerry died and even a little before then, I mean, I kind of checked out around 92 or 93, mainly because of that Brent thing. And then I saw my last show, like when, I think their last, tour through LA in 94. And then he died that summer. So, and for a lot of my friends too, it got buried because it was too hard to talk about. And then some, like, just like you said, like that, those reunion show, or those, there's like reunion show, the 50th anniversary. I mean, it really reawakened a lot of feelings and people, I think going to those shows and then having those experiences where, you know, you give a ticket or you hand out a miracle ticket and then, you know, someone kisses you later, a total stranger, or he hands you a poster, whatever, you know, people are just friendly to you. You're like, holy shit, I totally forgot about this whole vibe, this whole community. Yeah. And yeah, absolutely. I'm not letting go. Fuck no.
No, it's like coming home. Yeah, it was absolutely. Like coming home, you know, it was like coming home. It was this whole reawakening. It's, there's a Facebook group that, I belong to, one of many Facebook groups that I've been inducted into called, Born Again Deadheads. And I just love that term, like the Born Again Deadhead, because that's how I feel like I am. Like, I feel like, and a lot of times when people come back as a born again in any situation, you come back swinging even harder, right? Yeah. Like, you know, like I was this one strain, but now I'm like this crazy super strain of whatever it was before. So it's coming back home. And yeah, I don't think we're stopping anytime soon. So it's food for our soul. Woo-hoo! For sure. Well, thank you so much. And I think we could talk for another 2 hours, but I'm going to sign us off and I can't wait till we meet again.
Right on. Me too. Thanks very much, Stacey. I'm looking forward to seeing you next time.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. I mean,
thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
I'm Larry Mishkin, and I'd like to invite you to join Rob Hunt and me on our weekly podcast, The Deadhead Cannabis Show. Each week, we explore the latest cannabis and jam band news and reminisce with other deadheads and jam band lovers about the great musical acts that we've seen and heard. Check out a new episode every Monday.